like, something's not quite right. Something is off and I don't know how to handle it. I ask them, hey, what's wrong? And they say nothing, or they tell you that their tummy hurts, but that's really vague. So there's the subtle ones that where parents come in and they say, something else is going on. We're seeing these behaviors that aren't quite lining up. My intuition is telling me that we need a little more insight.
Hi, I'm Sarah Kuhn. Welcome to the Juno Women Podcast, where I sit down for candid conversations with women who are experts in their field and share their specific knowledge so that we can become better equipped to handle all things motherhood. Juno Women is an extension of Juna, a fitness and nutrition app created to help guide you through your trying to conceive, pregnancy, and motherhood journey. Everything we do at Juna is designed to empower and support you through one of the most incredible and challenging times of your life. Today, I'm talking to Jessica Schaefer. Jessica is a child counselor who specializes in working with children who have anxiety, sleep problems, or behavioral issues. We share some real-life examples of when play therapy would be helpful, and Jessica shares tips on how you can implement some of her findings in your own parenting. I hope you enjoy. Jessica, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. So thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
I just realized there's a lot of games in the background. I am guessing that you're in your playroom.
I am. This is where I come into the space. I'm even sitting on the floor because that is what my office looks like. I do my best work on the floor right here with the kiddos. So
I like it. Like it. Okay, why don't you start by introducing yourself and just telling us a little bit about you and your area of expertise.
Sure. So I'm Jessica Schaefer. I was born and raised in Boulder, Colorado, and currently have my practice here, and I'm choosing to raise my own two kids here. I grew up in the school system here, both private and public, and I went to CU and I graduated there in 2010, and then I went to Naropa University and graduated there in 17. And so Naropa University is really geared towards all sorts of counseling. At least the program that I was in, specifically the one I was in, was called transpersonal counseling. So it really tackled a whole lot of other forms of counseling, not just kind of a traditional talk therapy, or, I mean, there's really not much traditional about it, actually. And it opened up the doors for all these other areas that I could explore. I happened to encounter the woman who developed the particular form of play therapy that I practice here in Boulder through Naropa. It was like a one weekend event that she held, and I was hooked. And I just said, whatever you're doing, this is above and beyond what I'm learning here at Naropa. And I just kind of jumped on her bandwagon and learned as much as I could through her. And of course, that opened up a lot of other doors as well. So it was a pretty specific form of play therapy that I started practicing. And it happened to come on the heels of me also coaching other parents kind of by default. Similar, I think, is kind of what happened to you. Like, we have kids and all of a sudden we're like, wait a minute, like, we need help here. And we all need to be talking to each other, specifically about sleep. So I had my older son at the time, and who was an infant learning how to sleep. And I was struggling to find resources of people how to help me. And so that kind of started my journey on working with families and their children. It started with sleep specifically and counseling kind of on the side. And then I ended up merging them both into my practice. So I actually work with kids from about 4 months old until 10 is kind of my top cutoff, although that's not a hard cut. And we work everything, pretty much everything. I mean, there's not a lot of places where I would say that doesn't apply to what I do, but we certainly have a consistent caseload of kiddos with some level of anxiety somewhere. And so it shows up in all different ways. So, and I'm happy to be here to talk a little bit about one of those ways.
So it's interesting. I don't think that we've had, I don't think we've had anyone on the podcast come on, and it should definitely be like its own category when talking about kids and anxiety. Because I think, especially in, for me, when I thought about kids with anxiety, it was like much late, you know, like much later. My 7-year-olds can have anxiety, right? But, you know, now I have a 6-year-old and I'm like, oh, they definitely just shows up differently, right?
Right, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, even what ends up, what we now know about the bonding of mothers and infants is that a mother who is anxious throughout conception or throughout her pregnancy, labor, delivery, all of that gets transmitted to us in utero, and it can show up really quickly. So while I don't work with kiddos under 4 months old, because primarily the parents aren't equipped to be working at that time, right? We're just trying to survive those first couple months. But once we start actually seeing how a child or the infant is behaving and the mother or the primary caregiver are behaving, then we can start really seeing like, oh, these are behaviors that are tripping us up a little bit, or they're painting our world in a certain way that are making it more challenging than we would like to see. So challenge isn't necessarily bad, but sometimes we're like, "Ooh, this is, we're getting to be too much." Right.
Right. Right. Got it. Okay. So let's talk about specifically play therapy versus traditional therapy. And then, yeah, let's start there.
Sure. I can give you just a little history on play therapy in general. I think most adults in this culture are aware of like talk therapy. We imagine like going in and either lying on a couch or sitting in a chair across from someone, and then there's like this talking that happens. There's several other branches that come off of that for adults specifically. And so when that started to trickle down, where we started seeing how can we help the children, the little people, we started really on the East Coast with this very, what I would call, pragmatic approach to it, which actually is still helpful in many cases. But it's like, you go in, play, and I'll watch and take notes. And we analyze what that is going to be all about. And there's not a whole lot of intervention at that point. And then in California, there's the West Coast idea. This like happens all the time. But it came about where it's like, okay, well, actually, I'll get in there and play with you, or I'll let you play in a way that is more child-led, and you can choose what you want to play. Whereas East Coast was come in and play and draw this picture or play with this doll, or it was directive. So this form of play therapy that I practice is what I think of as kind of a happy medium. But the idea is that not only is it child-led, which it is, they can come in and bring whatever they want to bring in, they can play however they want to play, but the real magic, I think, of what happens in this form of play therapy is the relationship between me and the child. So it's called synergetic play therapy is the name of the whole modality. And that idea is that I really am the most important tool in the playroom. That's a direct quote from the founder of the movement. And where they can play with the toys and the puppets and the dolls and the paint, all of that is good. But really, it's what's going on with me and how am I as the therapist trying to reflect and learn from and then ultimately treat whatever is going on.
Okay. Oh, it's okay. So what is... for kids 4 months to 10 years, what is play therapy? Like, what would I as a mom come to you to work with my child for?
It really can be an array of things. I love it when the mother even reaches out to say, I think my kid needs more support. Oftentimes, I will say it is the parents that's making that initial phone call. Sometimes it's prompted by the school. The obvious ones are when like, oh, my kid keeps hitting other kids in class, or my kid seems to just have tantrums that last and I can't resolve them. But there's also the underlying ones that mommy intuition is like, something's not quite right. Something is off and I don't know how to handle it. I ask them, hey, what's wrong? And they say nothing, or they tell you that their tummy hurts, but that's really vague. So there's the subtle ones that where parents come in and they say, something else is going on. We're seeing these behaviors that aren't quite lining up. My intuition is telling me that we need a little more insight.
We're going to take a quick break so I can tell you about the Juna app, the app that makes this podcast possible. Juna is the premier app for every stage of motherhood, with a 12-week trying to conceive plan and workouts, key nutrition information for every week of pregnancy and postpartum, plus 6 full video courses on birth prep, breastfeeding, newborn care, infant sleep, sleep from 4 to 12 months, and starting solids. The app is designed to be your number one companion from trying to conceive through your baby's first year of life. It also includes daily diaphragmatic breathing exercises, pelvic floor prep, daily tips, and notes from me that are relevant to the exact things you are experiencing. These are so helpful for easing any fears and preventing the dreaded gestational Google mania, that sickness where you can't stop Googling every little thing that happens during pregnancy. Juna is available for both iOS and Android. Just search Juna in the App Store or go to juna.co. Again, that's juna.co. The app is completely free to try for 7 days, and if you decide it's not right for you, you can cancel anytime within the first week, no questions asked. Download Juna today and get started. Now, back to the show.
So there's that category. Then the other category is things that are much more obvious, right? Either a direct traumatic experience or kind of the pernicious traumatic experiences that are chronic or extreme. So those are instances where, like, this happened, we were in a car wreck, my child got bit by a dog, we're going through a divorce, we just had a death in the family. Those things where it's like, clearly, we need support. So then they come in kind of in more of a, what I would call a crisis moment.
Okay.
So that those two categories can come in, and it really can be anything that mommy intuition is saying, something's not quite right.
Got it. Okay. So, okay. So speaking specifically about, like, we can talk about both term, like, like a dog bite or a car accident, or, you know, like, even, you know, it's, even someone had messaged me on June, and they were like, I watched my kid get punched, my 3-year-old get punched in the face by another kid, and hit, and like that caught, you know, like that was a lot. Like, I think about how shocking that would be to the kid, you know, like, and then also to the parent, you know, like all these things.
Sure.
So is there any type of, let me take a step back. Is there, if a traumatic event happens and your kid seems to be not traumatized from it, is that I think about, like, love, I'll use my child as an example. Like, when our dog died, our dog just died, right? Like, it we talked about it. We talked about, you know, like, our dog going to doggy heaven. But it didn't seem to, and by the way, our first dog died in a very traumatic way, which we kind of shielded from our kids because it was crazy. You know, now that they're a little older, we did share what happened because the questions kept coming. But, like, in my mind, I'm like, it wasn't a traumatic event. However, my daughter for a year now, anytime that she's sad about anything, will say, I miss Rocky, and, you know, Rocky's, you know, like, and so now I'm like, oh, maybe there was something to, like, kind of poke around with, right? I guess. So you talk about mommy intuition, but, like, I guess, when are you like, you know what, I think my kid's handling this fine, versus it can't hurt to just go see someone?
Sure. Well, I'm definitely biased. It can't ever hurt, right?
I think can't ever hurt. I do.
Right, can't ever hurt. And it's worth it to just, if you are in that, like, hey, our dog just died and it's a really big deal to me, they seem to be handling it just fine, can you just check in with them? And so sometimes they'll come in and we'll see them for, I usually like to see them for at least 2 to 3 sessions at first, to see what's going on. And if it's bugging them, if something is in there, this, like, kind of unresolved grief, maybe it'll come up. And then we can say, oh, here it is. This is up in a way that is workable. And there are certainly times where, from our perspective as the parent, like, oh, that must have been horrible. You just got punched in the face. If that had happened to me, I would feel terrible. Whereas from that kid's perspective, because who knows what was leading up to that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it could have been days worth of it. Right.
Yeah.
And so maybe to them, they're like, oh yeah, nope. Saw that coming from a mile away. I knew that was going to do it. And now I have a plan and I'm good to go. And either it integrates and it's fine, or they shelve it and it's too much to even integrate at the time. And then it won't show up until later. Then we start seeing kind of these behavioral pieces. That's when I hope parents will remember being like, you know what? I do remember that one time in third grade when he got punched in the face and it just didn't seem to bug him. Or in the case of like, well, you know, now that their grandma died, it just seems, and we knew it was coming and it seemed like fine and we're all fine, but my daughter is taking it so hard and yet everything seems fine. So there's that incongruence and it's like, well, we did lose our dog when she was, and mm-hmm. she never talked about it much after that, or she would say that there was something going on, but never so much that I would bring her in. It's usually that she's like, oh, okay, I'm going to take this off the shelf and now I'm going to deal with death and loss and grief. So it can get re-triggered later.
Got it. And so you use the word integrated, and I want to talk about that, because basically, like, so so when someone comes into your play therapy studio, I don't know why I said studio, office,
it's called an office,
but it is kind of like a play studio. Yeah. They come in and you notice things that are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does the integration happen?
Mm-hmm. Right. So essentially what happens is there's the idea and the analogy that many people use in my field when we're talking about stress response or trauma response and how we react to things, right? A lot of us are very familiar with this idea of fight or flight. And so what's going on? There's a lot of neurobiology that happens. Now, I mean, in our whole, not just our brain, but our whole nervous system that contributes to our response system. And it's basically all these like little nerves in our body that are signaling to each other on how to behave based on the sensory input that's coming in, right? I mean, the senses are really unbiased. This is what I see. This is what I hear, smell, taste, feels like. And it's just dry data. The nervous system then interprets all those pieces of data and then decides what to do with it. And in some cases, they can say, danger. This is dangerous. So you lungs need to do this, and you heartbeat, you need to do this, and your eyeballs need to do this, and your muscles need to do this. So it's sending out instructions, which is really great and a very adaptive way of behaving if you're in an environment that really warrants that kind of response. What happens when we have a traumatic experience, or even something that we might not categorize as like a adverse childhood experience, but maybe something more mild, it's that we get stuck there. And then our nervous system will take in that same set of data that kind of looks the same or sounds the same or smells the same. And then it'll say, all right, go and do the thing that we taught you to do. So in the case of a dog bite, it would be like, okay, there's a dog, looks like a dog, smells like a dog, dog's not on a leash, and I'm here eating something. And the last time I was eating something and I saw a dog, it came up and bit me. So this idea that the brain and the nervous system can take in that data and have a certain response, that's the stuck piece. That's the behavior that you're seeing at home. In mm-hmm. play therapy, what happens is that the child will come in and in their dosage level, so like it could be a really small dose of this stress, isn't enough to kind of trigger a very mild response similar to what would be triggered if she saw the dog in the park. So she's going to come in and we're under her control, which is going to keep everything mild, more mild. She can trigger the same response and in the controlled environment with someone else to witness. So there's always a touch point of safety then we can go, okay, here's all the pieces. Looks like a dog, smells like a dog, or this looks like fear, smells like fear. My body is responding in the same way. Therefore, I'm going to scream, run away, fight back, fight or flight. Or there's a whole other category of freeze or even fall asleep, right? The overwhelm becomes so much that we just check out altogether. Mm-hmm. So we reenact this idea, but it's under their control. And therefore, they're able to interrupt with my guidance that whole process. So we interrupt it with ways that are much more adaptive than the very, in like the limbic system, right? The very low part of the brain to say, oh, when I see the dog and smell the dog in a park, I have to scream and run away or fight the dog back, whatever the nervous system is telling us to do. That instead, in the play therapy room, we can go, oh, wait. Oh, okay. That dog actually is not actually coming towards me. And so I'm fine. So that we get to interrupt that pattern of behavior.
Got it. Okay. So, and like, I'm just curious, is it depending on the trauma level? But like, I guess, how many times do you need to interrupt that like neurological response to then make that a habit?
That's a great question. I do think you're right in that it depends on the level of the level of adversity that it is, the number of times that it was happening. Was it chronic?
Right.
Is it still happening? Like if they have to go home that night and it's the abuse is still happening or the trauma is still happening, it's going to take a lot to kind of rework those pieces. How long ago it happened, how buried it is. But I would say that from a treatment perspective, I usually say that whatever the issue is comes up within the first 2 to 3 sessions, just to kind of depends on how fresh they experience it or are experiencing it in their daily life. And then I like to think of a round of play therapy lasting about 6 weeks. And by that point, we'll have discovered what is going on. We'll have tried on these new behaviors or interruptions to the old behavior. And then we start seeing what we call empowerment, where it's like, oh, I actually can change. I can interrupt it. I don't have to rely on Jessica to do it or mom or anybody else. I can rely on the interruption and go out into my world. So I would say 6 weeks is when I start usually seeing a big change, where they start really adapting it and making it a habit, which I had never actually thought about, but that's really what it is. We're changing old habits and responses into much more conscious ones that we can live in our daily lives.
Yeah. And so is like I think the way that you word it make it seem like it's conscious with the child. So like let's use a 4-year-old or even a 3 or 2-year-old who I don't believe to be, which I may tell it, but I don't believe my daughter would be capable of being like, mainly because like I don't even think that I'm capable of that, where I'm like, I can interrupt this is a stress cycle, this is what I, you know, like it's right. It's and so is it much more unconscious through practice with you?
Yes. So I would say the conscious part is happening on my end.
Okay. Got it.
And
okay.
So thanks for clarifying that. Yes. So on their end, absolutely. These are unconscious behaviors that are happening and unconscious responses that are happening. And we are interrupting them on an unconscious level. I'm aware of them as that witness on the outside and can track them so that I can see, oh, now I see how this is getting interrupted. So with confidence, I can say, great, I think that you have established these new behaviors. They don't really know the difference.
Right. And so that's why you say that you're the most important person in the room, because you have to notice when it's okay, this is making sense. Yes. Got it. Now, this is different than exposure therapy because, I want you to correct me where I'm wrong. So exposure therapy feels more conscious on like the patient side, right? Like it's like, I'm scared of, I'm scared of X. And so you're going to give me a little dose of X and we're going to see how I handle it.
Mm-hmm. So the difference there is who's in control. I mean, ultimately the patient is in control, right? Mm-hmm. The client. But really it's being, they're like the passive participant and saying, you're going to show me this thing. And I then have to just get used to, right? We call this a window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. I have to learn how to tolerate more and more and more and more exposure to this thing. That is an interruption. That is interrupting in very small doses, whatever the fear is, whatever the anxiety is. It's a really popular and I would say very effective, although I haven't actually read any direct studies that would support that. But from what I know of it, it is a very effective treatment for any phobia. So legitimate phobia, bridges, cats, spiders, dogs, things like that. I mean, you can have a phobia of anything, really. But that is a very direct way of curing that phobia, or at least widening our window of tolerance enough so that you can leave your house in case you might encounter whatever it is that you have this phobia of. So while that is great, it definitely, I think, is also more effective with adults and with the adult that can actually say, I know I am very afraid of X, Y, or Z. Whereas children, they don't really know what they're afraid of yet. They don't know. Sometimes it's not really, I'm afraid of dogs. That's our own adult language on might be what's going on for her. The idea is that they get to take whatever's going on in their body, fear, like that fear response, and put it out there. Like, this is what's going on. I don't have labels for it yet, but here's all the good stuff, all the sensations. And then from there, then we can start saying, oh, well, maybe it's just a fear of anything kind of coming at you. Or maybe it's a fear of something else that we say, well, that's a dog, but she might see a dog walking on a leash and it wouldn't trigger anything. I don't know. Okay. But that's where play therapy, we can get under all of that and say, oh, this is what actually is happening. That exposure therapy wouldn't be able to tackle necessarily.
Got it. Now, one of the things that I wanted to ask about, and it's specifically for those listening, my daughter was attacked by a dog a couple weeks ago. But my initial instinct, and I think a lot of parents' instincts, is to, we shouldn't go to the park because we don't want to see a dog and that will upset her and like all those things. And this is just like specific for a dog. There's a million different cases for this. And something about that didn't feel right to me because I was like, no, because then we're basically telling her fear of dogs is legitimate because at any minute a dog might attack her. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, and I think like with, like your feedback was, you know, like stay at the park. Don't pack up and leave because there's a dog there. Cause there's this is life. And there'll be a million other instances in which this is relevant too. And I think is that thought of, yeah, we're teaching them that this is an appropriate fear. what's the actual science I think behind that?
Sure. Well, there is some practicality around like, yeah, dogs can be dangerous. Right.
Yes,
like we
right.
don't want to just go up and pet any dog, or if a dog is running at you, run away. So there is some truth in that. And we have to balance it with not always. And you have the ability to make the child have the ability to make a decision on how to assess for safety. Mm-hmm. And we want to empower them.
Agency. Is it like basically like you have agency? Okay.
Right. Over your own sense of self. Now, we all make wrong choices and we all make good choices. And they all have consequences, right? So sometimes we do learn the hard way. Of course, we want to prevent the really hard ones, right? So we do want to say, yes, dogs can sometimes be dangerous. So giving them enough education around how to approach a dog or what to look for, like even teaching dog body language. I mean, in Boulder, I think we have like the highest number of dogs per capita, maybe in the country. I don't know. They're everywhere. And so learning, teaching our children or even learning ourselves, like, what's dog body language for a happy dog or an irritated dog?
Let's be honest. One of the hardest and most unexpected things about postpartum was feeding myself nutritious foods. Between trying to figure out my baby's sleep and feeding schedule, trying to keep the house in working order, trying to keep myself bathed and functioning, there was very little extra time to go grocery shopping or to do meal planning and go cook for myself and the family. Enter Home Chef. They have simple and delicious meals for every day of the week. You can choose between the oven-ready meals, which I highly recommend, especially in the early postpartum period, to ready in 15 minutes. The meals are healthy, easy to make, and make the cleanup process easy peasy lemon squeezy. Use the coupon code JUNA115 to get $35 off your first box, $30 off the second box, $25 off the third and fourth boxes. Trust me, this will make your life 1 million times easier when you don't have to think about feeding yourself and your family. Once again, go to homechef.com, pick your meals, and use the coupon code JUNA115 to get $115 off your first four boxes. Enjoy!
Or, you know, how do we learn enough in our environment so that when we take in all those data pieces, our nervous system can put those data pieces together to create the accurate response? So not, there's a dog, retreat. Or, that's a dog. What else am I seeing? Oh, I'm seeing that the dog's tail is wagging, or I'm seeing this, or I'm hearing this from its owner or something. I can put all those pieces together and then respond. So I think the idea around being very congruent with your messaging to your children, like, yes, in some cases, this is true, but also there are lots of other cases where it's not true. So how can we learn from that? And so much of it is learning what's going on in our own body. So in this instance of like, just stay in the park, right? We're not going to avoid it because stress and challenge, it's all actually good, right? In moderation, in small doses. Because it's kind of like lifting weights, right? Like we can lift a little weight and then the next day lift a little bit more weight and we get better and better at managing stress. So the more successful we are at managing small doses of stress, we will become competent to manage bigger ones. So staying with it is part of that, like lift the small weights just a little bit. Play therapy is even smaller, teeny weights, right? Just a little bit. And we get better and better, more empowered, more confident when we do encounter that situation, largely because we become more accurate in our data gathering. So staying in the park, you could just stay there and be like, okay, well, let's talk about the birds, right? You're in the park, but you're not really looking. Or you could be at the park and be like, okay, let's watch the dog, what it's actually doing, but also feel, like, I imagine her sitting on your lap and like, okay, so feel my hands on your heart. Okay, I feel your heart. Oh, it's beating really fast. I feel my heart. It's beating fast, not as fast as yours. Okay, I feel my breath. So now what we're doing is changing, and again, interrupting that data that's coming in that's saying, yes, I see a dog. I don't have to increase my heart rate and respiratory rate to get ready to run or scream or whatever. And she's doing it with you, right?
Co-regulating almost.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. That's okay. That's a fascinating. I feel like, that's so interesting. I have a question about untreated trauma. So how does untreated trauma show up in our kids' bodies? Like, I'll even go so far, because, like, let's say, because I'm sure this is, like, every parent's worst nightmare is, like, their kid being abused by somebody, and they don't know, right? Like, so what are ways that might show up in their body a little bit later? And we're like, oh, now it's, okay, something weird's happening.
Right. So what you're talking about are like signs and symptoms when if something has happened and you didn't know about it. Again, that mommy intuition, like just listen to that. And even if you're like, I don't even know, but their hair looks funny. And I just can tell, right? So it can be anything. I'll start there. But really, what we now know, especially about adverse childhood experiences, and those are called ACEs. There's a way to measure for them. And they've been studied over the years, like on long-term studies. What we see are physiological effects on what happens. So not only are you going to, early on, you'll probably see behavior changes. You'll see, it usually shows up in sleep pretty quickly. They're afraid to go to bed. They wake up in the middle of the night. If they're not processing it in their day life, they're going to practice it in their dream life. So now we're having dreams about the trauma we're having, or it's coming, we're having dreams about maybe not the direct trauma, but something else that's similar or evokes a similar response, because the brain is trying to integrate it. It wants to make sense of it so badly. So it shows up in sleep. It can show up in basic eating, like, oh, I'm not hungry anymore. Or we're trying to soothe through food where it's like insatiable appetite. I mean, it can show up in anything that way if we start dressing really differently. If they're all of a sudden they're like have to wear their coat zipped up to here and it's like 70 degrees out, you're like, you do not need a coat. Like, what's going on? And they're like trying to shield themselves from something. So again, kids are so creative. They're going to find any way to adapt and to soothe themselves. They will find a way to make it better. But what that turns into, obviously, if it goes on and on, are kiddos who are trying to soothe that become addictive and maladaptive, right? We're trying to soothe through substance or relationships or eating habits, or sleeping habits. So things that start showing up that's like, this isn't, it may have worked right in the moment. And now it's becoming maladaptive. And so if you let it go on, then you wait. It's not that it can't be done. It just takes a lot of work to peel back all those habits that were formed to get down to like, well, what are you really trying to heal here? And then we can get into it. So it's a lot more work as an adult than it is as a kid.
So that does lead me to my next question. Is it ever too late to start play therapy?
Never. I can't tell you the number of adults that come in and they say, maybe I should come in. Can I play in your sandbox? Right. And in all honesty, we do play as adults, and the adults who don't play, all work and no play, is really harmful for us. So we are able to integrate how we approach our world and our relationships when we can drop into that lower part of the brain and heal those things. And we do it through the language of play. We don't really know it, but that is kind of what's happening. So it's never too late to do it, but I would say that as a mom, as like whoever your listeners are, as the moms are out there and like, oh, well, now my kid is 13 and she's like going through all these changes. Does she go through play therapy? And in theory, of course, she totally could. And this modality actually has been translated into working with adolescents and even adults and horses and dogs and all sorts of things. It's really their openness at that time. And that's why I say 10's not a hard cutoff. I certainly have 11-year-olds who want to come in and still play with all the army men, and they still want to like do their artwork and express themselves that way. But they're going to come into a playroom with like Candyland and dress up clothes. So at some point they're going to be like, this isn't a good fit for me because I'm not a baby anymore. But it's never too late to go back and look at those early things. I mean, the sooner the better, really. And we all have them. We all have these voids and gaps that happened to us in our life as we were growing up that we still haven't fully integrated.
I was just talking about ACEs with someone, and I'm forgetting what the context of it was. And he said, so you'll probably know it because I do not know it off the top of my head, but like, what is this, like when you have adverse childhood experiences, the single most important thing is having a caregiver that a caregiver that you like trust. Am I making that up? What was
so relational health? There's like this idea of relational health. There's this indicator when they study ACEs that even if you had a high number of ACEs, so high number of adverse experiences, and that could be like four would be a high number. Most of us have one,
right?
Somewhere in there. But if you have four, now you're looking at, you're in a whole nother category for health problems, short life expectancy. I mean, it gets to be a bigger, really, it becomes a bigger social issue.
It's like diet, your likelihood of diabetes, heart, like all the, right? Like it's crazy.
But it all goes way up. Mm-hmm. And of course, we see that in certain communities over other communities. Really from a social work perspective, it's a big indicator of health. But what they see is that this particular study is that the adults who had a high number of ACEs had less symptoms, so physiological symptoms, mental health symptoms, if they had strong relational health. So what we mean by relational health is if they're able to have at least one significant relationship in their world that is healthy, so that is, has integrity, that is trustworthy and safe. If they have at least one, just one, it can be a teacher, a counselor, cousin, an aunt, an uncle, a coach, anybody, that if they have that and can continue to model after that, that is one of the best counter indicators of the health risks of having ACEs. And I would remind people that when we do talk about adverse childhood experiences, in particular about the ramifications of diabetes and shorter lifespan, things like that, is they're very adverse, right? I mean, divorce is probably the most mild one on there. Mm-hmm. And that is really hard. But like domestic violence, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, there are big ones on there that really indicate some of these bigger issues. So again, understanding that those stresses, those adverse experiences are really tough, and we want to avoid those at all costs. But then there's other ones that can be more minor that we can learn to integrate that won't create such a huge ramification. And then there's ones that we actually want to promote, right? Mm-hmm. Fail the test. Fail. Mm-hmm. Ask the girl out on a date. She might reject you. Like, it may feel to that teenage heart that that is so dramatic, but it's not, right? It's going to actually build the resilience and confidence that we want to see in kids. There's some studies coming out now about COVID that aren't conclusive yet, at least to my knowledge, that we're actually, like, we did so well of protecting our children from COVID, we think, or we tried to, that we now it's like, they haven't been challenged enough, right? Mm-hmm. We've had this like, oh, it's okay. Like, you don't have to go to school because of this, or it's okay, you don't have to go to the party, right? We've been so insulated that we haven't been pushed or stressed in a way that is building these children's confidence or resilience to things.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've been reading this book, and I'd love to have the author come on as well, but it's How to Raise an Adult.
It's
you're just like, oh my God, the helicoptering and the snow. I mean, I'll call it snow plowing. It's like, I don't want you to experience any type of stress or negative feelings. And it is interesting because every parent's instinct is to protect their kid, right? But like, have we gone a little far? And and I started reading that book right after, Kyla's the dog incident. And that same weekend, my son fell off a play structure. Like, you know, I mean, it was, I still have like visual, like, I can't believe he's okay. But that book made me feel a little bit better because I was like,
yeah,
like he wanted to go to the top. Like I was checking on my other kid who was in the river, you know, like I can only be so many places. Like part of being a kid is assessing risk and knowing when you've gone too far. And if you take all that away, then it's going to be really hard to learn.
Yeah.
Exactly. And assess risk on your own. Right. Yeah, like, and at some point they will need to be able to assess risk because we do want to send them out into the world. Right.
Like, exactly. And I think that's where play therapy comes in, is they're able to come into a contained space. Not that it can't happen out in the open. It certainly can and is practiced outside. But they get to come in with things that are under their control and press the boundary without breaking an arm, right? Or falling off the top. Or so there is this amount of like, how can we get them to step forward and step into some sort of decision making and assess like, I don't know, like, should I build the tower higher? Because if I do, it's going to come all tumbling down. And then what happens? Like, and then how do I deal with that? Or if I do paint like this, if is the paint going to come out the way I want it to? Or is it going to get ruined? What if I show it to mom and she doesn't like it? Like, so we're pushing those boundaries all the time. In the playroom, we get to deal with it in, again, very small doses.
Now, well, my last question, and you've started to touch on it a little bit, but I think as a parent that obviously has my kid in play therapy, I have no idea what goes on in the room. And I think, you know, for people listening too, I'm curious how, like, is it all a theoretical thing? Like, are you, I guess what I'm struggling to understand is how do you relate, like if like I'm playing Candyland with you and my daughter got bit by a dog and that's why she's seeing you, how does the dog incident like how do you like weave it in, like how do you weave in the thing so that you're then understanding what like what really is going on bodies in a way that you don't have to answer that specific way, but I'm curious how you weave this into play.
Well, the first answer is that I don't. They do.
Oh, okay.
That's kind of a bigger kind of step back is like, oh, this is all child led. And in fact, sometimes we come, like a child will come in and the parent will say, they're in here because I know this is really hard for them. They're going through this thing. And so we want them to address this with you. And they come in and that is not what they're coming in to talk about or play about or whatever. It's actually this whole other thing that's up. And they're like, if I can talk to you about anything or play any way I want in here, then let me tell you what's actually going on for me. Then that becomes my job of saying, whoa, what's coming in is a whole lot of fear. And so we think that this kid is really angry and lashing out at his parents, but what's actually coming in is a deeply rooted fear somewhere. Mm. Okay, so let's say, because we're not talking about the fear, they come in and they want to play Candyland, right? Number one game still in the playroom. And each board of Candyland is different. So depending on, I'm very familiar with my board, but I'll switch out boards sometimes because they have different characters on them. And there's like, some of them are really long and some of them are short. But the idea is it's not that they're playing Candyland. It's how they're playing Candyland and how am I allowed to play Candyland? What's coming up in the dialogue between Candyland? So, again, I mean, most parents, I'm assuming, are familiar with the game, but there's kind of always a scary bad guy in the middle. And otherwise, it's like all this beautiful candy around the outside. And I definitely, if I know some of the story, as we get closer to that bad guy, am I nervous? Am I nervous that I'm getting close to the bad guy? Okay, not in real life. Like my stronger witness brain knows that I'm just playing Candyland. But if I drop back down into my limbic system,
And I'm like, if I were really approaching this kind of darker, scarier looking guy thing, right? I mean, it depends on how old the kid is. But if I'm approaching that, like, what's going to start happening for me? I might be like, I kind of just don't even want to play this game anymore, or I want to skip over it. So I'm paying attention not only to myself and what's going on to me, but how are they responding? If they're like, ooh, you're stuck with the bad guy, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. Like, now you're stuck. What are you going to do? You're stuck with the bad guy. So it's a little metaphorical in that sense, but mm-hmm. it's also energetic. There is like a sense of what's coming up, and all of a sudden Candyland becomes very informative, right? Do we mm-hmm. do we try to skip it? Sometimes kids will try to cheat their way through it, mm-hmm. and they'll be like, oh, I'm just going to skip right to the ice cream. And
so is that when you're like, oh, they're trying to shelve it? It's like something like that is indicative to you that they're actually just trying to set it aside for a minute.
Maybe.
Or, okay.
I would say maybe. It depends on if they're like trying to do it and tell me about it. Mm-hmm. Are they trying to do it and keep it a secret? Mm-hmm. Do they just do it and not even notice they're doing it? Or did they do it and I called them out? And then what's their response when they get called out? I mean, it just is.
Yeah. Okay.
Not one session is the same ever in the 7 years I've done this. Not once. I mean, I've played so many games of Candyland, I can't tell you. And they all are different. They're all different.
That's nice. It's nice to go to work and play Candyland, right?
Sometimes. Although sometimes I really enjoy the adult conversation, right? Switching, getting out of my own limbic brain and being like, what am I actually doing?
Yes.
Work? But yeah, in general, it's a great profession. So.
No, I appreciate this so much. I think it's when I brought it up on my Instagram account, I couldn't believe how many other people had experienced like a dog attack and also had been traumatized from it for 15 years. You know, like there's so many people where like I wasn't able to go near dogs for 15 years. It's so mm-hmm. Good thing that you're doing. And I was just like, yeah, like the initial thought for me was, we're a dog family. Like we just happen to not have a dog right now because, you know, I call Levi my puppy. I'm like, I need to not have a puppy before we get a new puppy.
Right. Exactly.
But like, I can't imagine my kid, like, you know, my kids having this fear based on an experience. It makes me so sad. Cause like, I literally, when it happened, I was like, this is going to be the rest of her life. So hopefully it's not, but for so many people it is. And it's so great that you are doing what you're doing and, you know, able to help so many kids and families out. So, mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. It definitely, it's an honor. Every family I do get to work with, I know that I'm coming into a scary spot. I mean, by the time parents come out to me and reach out and their kid shows up in my office, it likely is not due to a lack of trying everything else. Right. And it's like, we really are concerned. And as a mother myself, when you hand your child over to someone else to say they're struggling, it's a scary spot to be in. Mm-hmm. So I really do value all the families that bring them in to me and of course try to do my best to help them and sometimes end up pointing them in other directions. Like, wow, this is really helpful. But also like this could also be really helpful. There's people, we're so lucky to be in a place where there's professionals who are so smart and able to help each other. So as long as we can all just keep doing our part, I think that that's really important.
Yes. Well, why don't you tell people where they can find you mm-hmm. in the event that they might need some help too.
Sure, of course. My website's the best way to find me. So it's shuteyecounseling.com. And you can schedule appointments through there. You can just get some of your basic questions answered. Of course, I would love to talk to you and again, encourage you that even if you're like, I just want to see if maybe we need it, then go ahead and call. I mean, I'd rather have you reach out and then say, actually, I think we're okay, than mm-hmm. not at all. So if it's keeping you up at night or you have that mommy intuition that's saying, maybe we need a little bit of help, then trust it. Trust that something's going on. Your kid will thank you.
Yeah. And we should definitely have you back on for a sleep podcast.
Oh, yeah. I'll think sleep. That is every mom's. Like, I'm just like, have someone help.
Totally.
And by the way, like, it's so funny. I have, you know, a 6'4" and a 2-year-old, and it's just, my kids have been sleeping through the night, you know, since they were, no, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months. But the new things always come up. They always come up. So you might think, I got a good sleeper. And then, I don't know, the 18-month sleep regression hits, or 2 years, or something happens, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it is endless.
Yes. I would say sleep is a symptom, right? How we're sleeping is so indicative of what's going on in our life, our whole life, throughout the lifespan.
Yes. That is true for me. I mean, it's like true.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jessica. I really appreciate you coming on.
Of course. It was my pleasure.
Okay, that's all for today. If you liked today's episode, please share it with a mama friend and leave us a review. If you're pregnant, postpartum, or trying to conceive, you can download the Juna app completely free for 7 days. It's available for iOS and Android and is designed to be your guide for all things health and fitness for this very special time of your life. If you have any suggestions for episodes you would like to hear, or anyone you think would be a great guest on the show, please email me directly at sarah@juna.co. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week.